You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1974, the brutal murder of Anita Fagiani Andrews, a 51-year-old former beauty queen and mother of two, shook the small working-class town of Napa, California. Detectives, criminalists, and forensic experts raced to identify who'd struck Anita down in her own bar, but despite their efforts, the case went cold. Decades passed, during which the town grew into a world-renowned wine region and tourist destination, but the case remained an open question. After 37 years, thanks to DNA evidence, the killer, in prison for a different murder, was finally found and brought to justice. Join author and retired judge Raymond A. Guadagni as he tells the story of the shocking murder, the investigation, and the subsequent trial over which he presided in 2011. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Napa Murder of Anita Fagiani Andrews, a cold case that caught a serial killer, with my special guest, judge and author, Raymond A. Guadagni. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Raymond Guadagni.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much. Let's start with just your background, and we mentioned in the introduction that you are the presiding judge in this case, so just give us a little bit of your legal background before we get into talking about Napa, California, and 1974.
All right. I was an attorney in 1972, and got a job as a deputy public defender in Stockton, California. And then after 3 years of being a deputy public defender, I moved back to my hometown of Napa County and practiced law in a general civil and criminal area. And then in 1995, I was appointed to the Superior Court bench as Napa's first Superior Court commissioner. And then in 2001, in January, I was appointed as a Superior Court judge and then retired full-time after at the end of 2012.
Now, this story is set in Napa, California, 1974. And Napa, for those people who don't know, is nearby Vallejo, California, 13 miles away.
Correct.
Mostly white population. At some point experienced some significant growth, but it was considered a really safe community, and criminal activity was so minimal that you write that there was no public defender's office. Crime rate didn't warrant it. So let's talk about Napa in 1974, but especially Fagiani's cocktail lounge and the district that it's in, the area that it's in. As you do in the book, describe this Napa, California, and this area with bars and Fagiani's cocktail lounge.
Sure. Napa back then was not known for its wine. It was known for the Napa State Hospital and also for prune picking. And then a big employer was the Mare Island Naval Shipyard in Vallejo, which, as you said, is only 13 miles away. By law enforcement standards, they described it as a whiskey and beer drinking town. There were 21 bars in the city and several just outside the city limits. In the area where Fagiani's bar was, that was Main Street, and that's where there were a host of bars, I think 11 in a two-block area. I may be wrong on that, but that was they were kind of an outgrowth of World War II, when people would get home on leave and they'd go to bars and hang out and talk and reminisce. Fagiani's ended up being an old-timers bar at the end, because Nicola Fagiani, the owner and the person who started it in 1945, had passed away. And so his two daughters had to run it, and they felt they had to run it because of its enviable liquor license. It was a on-sale, off-sale. So that made Fagiani's a liquor store as well as a bar.
Tell us a little bit about Anita Andrews, Fagiani Andrews, and about her other work that she had other than this job. You write about that the daughters felt it necessary to keep this bar going because they inherited it from their father, but you talk about them not having any staff. So tell us about Anita, her other work, and what she was like, and just the other circumstances regarding this bar.
Sure. Anita, at the time of the murder, was 51 years old. She grew up in Napa, in Little Italy, which was an area of Napa in the east. And she worked full-time at the Napa State Hospital as a secretary on the grounds. And after Nicola, her father, passed away, she worked part-time, continued working as a secretary at the state hospital, and then worked part-time at the bar to keep it open with her sister, Muriel. Now, Anita was the personable one. She was really good with people. She, in fact, at 18 years old, she was the Napa County beauty queen, Miss Napa County, and real popular. Muriel was a school teacher but didn't like dealing with the public, so she ran the books, so to speak, and so Anita was in the bar most of the time.
What was a characteristic in terms of where she parked her vehicle and what was her vehicle, in fact? And then also, you talk about that there was a routine police patrol, and they knew the sisters as well. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. She owned, Anita did at the time of her death, a 1967 Cadillac. And it the routine of the police in a small town, they know the circumstances and the bar owners, and they regarded Fagiani's as just kind of an old-timers bar, not much action after Nicola died. But they would patrol it by just going around the block. They'd patrol it maybe 3 to 5 times every evening. And if they saw the front door bolted, locked, and the lights, the sign off, and her car gone, they knew everything was okay. They knew Fagiani's was closed. On this particular occasion, it wasn't that way, and unfortunately wasn't noticed by the patrol officer. They would just drive by with their spotlight. But if they did, they would have seen it unlocked, and the inside light was on, and the car was gone, which may have given them pause to go check it out, which if they would have, they would have discovered either the murder in progress or, more probably, Anita's body, which would have given them a head start to find that car.
Unfortunately, they didn't, and we're talking about July 10th, 1974.
Correct.
There's three characters, Al Mufich, Al McKenzie, David Luce, and they're going to this happy hours bar for a beer, but they also have to visit this pizza parlor where Al McKenzie is a steel guitar player in this band, but they have a little bit of time. So tell us what these three guys do after they leave the happy hours bar, and what happens at Fagiani's.
Sure, sure. Happy Hours, it was a very small base-like brick building. It still exists today. It's Edward Jones' financial advisor. And anyway, it was just a beer joint. I think beer and wine, maybe. It was very small, but very close in distance, Fagiani's. Happy Hours on 4th Street, Fagiani's on 3rd and Main. So, and they were walking, I think, because of alcohol intake. And so they walked to Fagiani's and walked in. And when they walked in, David Luce said they like to sit at the end of the bar with a view towards the entrance and exits because they, I guess, had been in fights before. And one of the guys, was a real loudmouth. The other two were pretty civil, but he just spoke his mind. He was a native Napan, and also in the bar was this person down at the end of the bar talking to Anita. And he covered his face with his hand and kept his head down, smoking a cigarette and drinking a beer. And Al McKenzie or Mufidge, I'm forgetting now which one, was the boisterous one, shouted out at him saying, "Hey, you," and he called him a son of a bitch. "Hey, you son of a bitch, what are you hiding from?" To which the suspect did nothing. And then Luce was... apparently, they'd been kicked out of bars before, at least the hothead had been, and they didn't want another lifetime banishment from Fajani's. So he went to make peace. He went to the bathroom, and on the way back, stopped and shook this man's hand and said, "Don't mind Al, he doesn't mean anything by it." And the guy shook his hand, but still barely looked at him, although later we heard that Luce said it was about 30 seconds. So he did get to see him, get to hear him, and you know, could describe him later.
Mm-hmm. Now you take us to her next day, July 11th, and this is early in the morning, 8:40 in the morning, and her sister Muriel, Anita's sister Muriel, and they're very close, she gets a call from her mother. What's this call about, and what does this lead to Muriel going and doing?
Yeah, you're totally right, Dan. The mother, I don't know why she called Muriel because Anita was missing. She may have called the state hospital to talk to her daughter, but she called and said, "She's not at work yet. Could you go down to the bar and see what's going on?" They were a very close family. Muriel never married and was super close to Anita, so she drives down there and discovers her sister and calls the police.
Now, what does she discover? And she calls police, and so what does she discover, or what do police discover?
Sure. Muriel finds Anita's dead body in the storage room, laid out on the floor with in a pool of blood, and calls the police, and they come, and they find that too, and they immediately wanted to secure the crime scene. But they could not get Muriel to leave her sister's side. They said she was extremely calm, although they interpreted that as being in shock, because she just said, "This is my sister, and I think she's been raped." And finally, with the coaxing, a few more police officers came that were old guard, and they knew her personally, Muriel, and they got her to finally go and sit in the police car outside the bar.
You talk about various officers arriving, Captain Burnsid, Lieutenant Bailey, and Sergeant Kemper, but they talk about, you just mentioned that her sister thought that she had been raped. What was it that about her clothes that they thought, what was it about her appearance that they thought she was raped? And also, what else was the condition of her body? What had happened to her that they could see?
Yeah, sure. She had been stabbed, later evidence said, 13 times with this screwdriver in the neck, but one of her stockings had been removed on one of the legs, which we found out later was a signature of this guy. And so that was down. Her vaginal area was exposed, so she did look like she was at least a victim of a sexual assault, if not a rape.
Right. Right, and her breasts were exposed as well, you write,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
Now, very early on, you write that there was David Luce at the Happy Hours bar. Now, how does David Luce contact police, and what are the circumstances in that regard? While they're still investigating this, how do they find out about David Luce?
David Luce went the next day to the Happy Hours to retrieve his vehicle. I guess he did have his vehicle there. And when he got there, word had spread somehow, and so he called in to say, "I was there last night with my two buddies, and there was a guy there." So he contacted the police, and they had him over right away to question him.
And what does he have to say about what happened, and was he able and you had mentioned that he did get to look at this man much better than his friends because he was hiding his face initially. But what is the description he gives to police, and what else does he tell them about his
encounter? He describes the open collar shirt and his hair, which is thinning. The suspect's is thinning by then. The one thing that was very odd, he said he actually shook his hand and described it as real spongy and wet and milk toasty. In fact, it really hit home with David Luce. He said he only remembered one handshake like that in his entire life, and it was with Richard Nixon when Nixon was touring and he was in Alaska and he met him and shook his hand. So he remembered that. And that's about it. He said, I can't remember now, Dan, if the suspect even talked back except to say, you know, don't worry or something like that. And then David pursued it one more. He said, well, is this your boyfriend, Anita, or something like that? And she said yes. They all think it was just to end the conversation and get rid of him. And so he went back to where his buddies were sitting.
Right. Now, what do they do? Did they get him to create a composite? Is a composite created? And as per procedure, you talk throughout this book about the thoroughness and the following the letter of the, following the book with the NAPA. So what do they initially do as per procedure, checking any viable suspects that, tell us about that.
Sure. That's a very good question because I was impressed with their thoroughness. They, immediately closed the bar, which would have been standard. Jim Boitano, the district attorney, who had been the district attorney, I think, for four terms, not at that time, but he was in the middle of a term. He was known as a very frugal Italian from Genoa, Italy, and he didn't like to spend much money. But even Jim Boitano called Berkeley and got an expert criminalist to come down and reconstruct the crime scene. And so they preserved everything, tons of photographs. There was a little stub of a cigarette right on the bar where the suspect had been sitting and smoking. They preserved that. And, this is before DNA was in vogue. It may have been known about or invented, but it wasn't. There was no CODIS or anything you could send in the indexing on. Anyway, so they preserved all that. They immediately went to logical places, like they contacted her ex-husband, Mike Andrews, and then they contacted, she had an ex-boyfriend, but a recent ex-boyfriend, and they had parted in a fight over, he ran up a big bill on the phone, and she kept his tools. He was a mechanic guy and kept his tools until he paid her back, so there was a lot of talk about that. And then they interviewed the people at the state hospital because she did come in contact with the patients, and some of which were violent and rapists and murderers. And then finally they went across the street, not finally, but they went across the street to the old Connor Hotel, which after Governor Reagan, the future president, had kind of let out all these state hospital patients, including PTSD Vietnam veterans, and they all stayed at the Connor that was kind of financed by the county. So there were a lot of troubled people there, so they went through the whole index there. And then they contacted all the local bars because bartenders, were kind of a close-knit group, and they knew everybody. Each would go over to the other when they closed and maybe had a beer with them. And so they contacted all of them to see if they saw any weird characters. And, of course, they went to her house and interviewed neighbors and things of that nature.
Right. Let's use this opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, you talked about they were looking and following all the possible leads, but there was a person named Feliciano that was interviewed. And what does he tell them? He's a resident of the Connor Hotel. What does he tell them about Fagiani's bar?
Yeah, that seemed significant at the time, but didn't pan out. But he had he had seen a light on or something very late, and you may have to help me, Dan. Did Feliciano go into the bar himself or not?
Feliciano was actually the person that was in the bar and saw two different people. First time he had gone in at 4:45, and then later he had returned at 7:15. And so he had saw two different males in there at different times, and one man had offered to buy Anita and a man a drink, or he had offered to buy Anita a man a drink. So he had a Southern accent, and he was possibly Texan, and so, again, a lead for police to follow up, however.
Correct. That's spot on. Now, and thank you for that. And he reported it. But he was pretty spot on, as it turns out, but nothing came of that. I don't know if he contributed to the composite that they drew besides David Luce, but nothing, they weren't able to find anything, and I guess he wasn't registered in the Connor.
Mm-hmm. You write there was another man named Liston Casey Beale that supposedly fit the description somehow. So they checked out Beale, and some investigators thought that Beale was good as a suspect, didn't they?
Absolutely. Liston Beale was a guy that some of the police officers could not let go of. Even 20 years, 25 years later, he was the favorite suspect of some of the officers. They never ruled him out until they finally got to DNA.
Right. So they check out all these people, but this case goes cold.
It does.
From there, how many years is it before there is any activity? And in the interim, is there any leads that come in? Is there any task force set up? Is there any way for people to contribute to this investigation? How open is this investigation in that interim?
Well, there's one significant thing I left out, which was a few weeks after the murder, the Bank of America contacted the police with a credit card receipt from her Cadillac. And that was the night of the murder, or I believe the very July 10th. It may have been the early morning hours of the 11th. And it was in Sacramento, near the Stockton 99 turnoff, there was a station there, and I think it was Satoni's or something like that. And they contacted and they looked at the credit card receipt, and it was signed, I think, A. Andrews, and it was for $10. That was the only place they could follow that car was to Sacramento, and then they lost all sorts of leads after that. And then as far as going cold, Muriel Fajani, this was her beloved sister, and she was kind of a gadfly at council meetings. She would show up. She was very intelligent, would ask good questions, and she was aggressive in that way, and so she would nag the police. So she was always on them, and she preserved the bar. She shut the bar down the next day when she discovered her sister, and never reopened. She didn't care about the liquor license then, and kept it just the way it was. It was like frozen in time, because over the years, there was redevelopment. The Connor Hotel was raised. They built a veterans park there, and new businesses came and went. But not Fajani's. It just stayed closed. She paid the electric bill. The phone worked. Kids would go down, including my brother and I. I was a young lawyer then, but we'd look through the window to look at the old bar and the stool. She must have been cleaning up, and they were all lined up, and the stool where the suspect was still pushed out for some reason. Well, she would always go to them saying, look, this isn't a reconstruction. This is your crime scene. Come in anytime you want. So they did periodically do it. There just was no need after a while. But they would go in and get a case of the beer bottle empties and check them out for further prints as time went by. And then plus it's a small town, so this was a horrific murder for little old Napa then, and it was you know, that pushed it too. But like all cold cases, after a while, the community wanted the police to work on the current cases, and so it just, and we had no cold case with the police department or the sheriff's. Had no cold case department, to work on these things. So anyone who wanted to would have to work on it on their own while doing their current caseload. But there were plenty of devoted cops. My respect for the police really went up. I guess as much as it's terrible for a family, I think it's pretty bad for a law enforcement officer who can't solve the crime for the community and for the family. So some
Absolutely.
Of them... just couldn't stand it, and it bugged them. So they kept working as time permitted.
Mm-hmm. You write about over the ensuing decades, the forensic science grew by leaps and bounds. Sophisticated technologies were developed. Among them, computers were a big boon to scientific investigation and for the legal community and the law enforcement community. And then also fingerprint technology and also the being able to put those into systems to see if they were a match that was a big development in fingerprint technology and databases to be able to submit to. You talk about Detective Don, I hope I don't mispronounce this, Winiger, and this is May 2006.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about Winiger and May 2006. He's assigned to the cold case homicide in Napa County. So tell us about what he learns and his interest in this case and what he does as a result.
Sure. Well, as you say, the CODIS, which is, I know you know about it, but it blended the forensic science and the computer technology into this tool for linking violent crimes. So in that way, the federal government, the state governments, local forensic laboratories, they could exchange and compare DNA and prints and profiles electronically. So that, of course, was a big boom to the law enforcement community because they could use it for suspects and known offenders and missing persons. Winiger, when he gets assigned, as you know, they didn't have a cold case unit, so he was still ordered to continue with his caseload and work on this as he could. Another very good officer, Todd Schulman, was assigned to another cold case. So the two of them split this up, but Winiger had only the Fajani case. He describes it as being assigned and given like five boxes to reorganize and then go to the evidence storage locker and get more things, and he had to organize it. And, over the years in these storage places and dusty buildings, it's hard. Some things end up missing. They never could find anything but a photocopy of the gas receipt, for instance. But Winiger organized it very well and made a very detailed timeline and ended up, when they finally got a match, he ended up tracing that person from his birth to the crime, except for the last 4 months, which to this day bothers him. He couldn't mm-hmm. Figure out where he was. But anyway, that's what he did. He just worked, and the more he worked, the more he got caught up in it. And but you're right. He didn't get assigned till 2006. Like in 2000, DNA was super expensive in those years. And they couldn't just send it in. There was no CODIS. But in around 2000, one of the officers, really dedicated, brought it to a conference on DNA in 2000, and they took a sample. And, they needed huge amounts of material to do a sample, and it cost thousands of dollars. So he tried to get a free one at the conference, but nothing came of that. But after 2006, Winiger, he benefited by the fact that it was really advanced then.
Yeah, you talk about September 2009. enters into CODIS, doesn't get a match. But a month later, November 5th, 2009, he gets another call. And the day that search was conducted, there was a match. Now, who is this match, and what do they find out about who this guy is, and where is he?
Yeah, you're right. He submits it, and then a year or whatever goes by, and I think part of that, I've talked to DOJ about that, and they just said, you got to remember, we're working on current murders. And so anyway, it took a long time, but they get a match. Detective Weiniger was, you know, just so happy to hear that. And it was Roy Allen Melanson, and he was in, Fort Lyon, state prison in Colorado. And he was in there for murder of Michelle Wallace, who was killed in Gunnison, Colorado, 50 days after Anita was. It's just that they never caught him for the murder, and he didn't go to trial on that till 1993. But there he was, sitting there with that match.
Now, you talk about Weiniger going to see the DA, Gary Lieberstein.
Yes.
And he assigns it to the deputy DA, Paul Giroux.
Giroux? Yes, Giroux.
And they began to develop a plan for prosecution. What does Giroux ask Weiniger to do and be part of?
Yes, Giroux forms a trial team, so to speak, his own team. And he, of course, goes with Weiniger, the chief detective on this case, and then he selects Leslie Severe. She got married since. It's Leslie Pate, who was an investigator, an extraordinary investigator. So he had kind of, in my view, an all-star team, and he divided up the tasks. And so he had, of course, Weiniger, assemble all his police reports and organize them. He already had his timeline, and be in charge of that and witnesses. But he had Pate go out of town and interview witnesses that were around. Her job was to research Melanson's past, and that's when they discovered what they were dealing with.
Yes, so tell us what they do discover about his illustrious past, other than he's sitting in prison for murder.
Right.
But also that you talk about Paul Giroux flies to Colorado to interview Melanson. So let's talk about first about what do they find about his background and some of his criminal past.
Yeah, they find several convictions initially for rape only, and then it's like he evolved into from a serial rapist to a serial murderer. He would rape victims and then get convicted. So on a few of them. And so I guess he learned by that I should kill them. So he started killing them. It started out, as best as I can remember, with his 16-year-old cousin, that he was going to rape her when the dad came home and broke it up. And I think they brought charges, but nothing came of that. And then an African-American lady who was a maid and finished cleaning her boss's place, and she left, and Melanson pulled her over, pretending to be a cop, and then he raped her. And she testified, and he was convicted. But that was she was so young, and she hadn't been married yet. And when Leslie Severe called her to interview her, she just broke down crying. It really bothered me because she had never told her future husband or her children about that. And anyway, so there was that, and then he traveled. he was real at home in Texas and in Louisiana, and he raped and murdered other people besides Michelle Wallace in Gunnison.
You talk about the rape of Sandra Arnold in February 1974, and then to Napa, where he murdered Anita Andrews on July 10th. And then later, 50 days later, as you mentioned, August 30th, Michelle Wallace.
Right.
And then you have all the details. We get those all those details a little bit later. So they go to interview him. And what is the strategy to be able to elicit information from him, and how well do they do in that? Tell us about that interview.
Yeah, I know they did very well. I know that Detective Weiniger was very pleased because Melanson didn't even have to talk to him. But Melanson's, I guess, ego was such that he came across as, "I have nothing to hide." Detective Weiniger's style, his best style anyway, is not acrimonious or aggressive. He's just kind of an easygoing personality. He's easy to talk to. And Melanson, by the way, is easy to talk to too. He's very personable. I can see how he could really take advantage of someone because you start to trust him. And so the two of them were talking very easygoing, and it was in that way that Weiniger brought up, the reason I'm here, Roy, is we're looking at a murder in Napa, California, and it was in 74, and blah, blah, blah. And Melanson said, "Oh, well, hold it right there. I've never been to Napa. I've never been to California." And Weiniger just said, "Well, this may be a shorter interview than I thought." And then he kept pressing on it, but in a gentle way. And I think Melanson did say, "Well, you know, I may have been in California. I went through nettles or something, but I've never heard of Napa." You know, well, immediately the interview was worth the price of admission because they had his DNA in Napa, in the bar. So Weiniger already had him impeached for his credibility if it went to trial.
Now they have this information, and so we have Paul Giroux. He has an option to be able to take this to a grand jury indictment or through the regular route where a judge would determine if there's probable cause to take it to trial. And so
Correct. What
is his decision and why?
He files the complaint, but he does take it to the grand jury. I'm not sure exactly what was going in his mind or the trial team's mind as to why they take it there, but grand jury is sometimes not trusted because only the DA's there. You don't put on a defense. The defense isn't there. The defendant isn't there. And it's one-sided, and a lot of times a grand jury, many times, just rubber stamps what the DA is showing. But he laid it all out then. At a preliminary hearing, that wouldn't have happened, and it would have been much more advantageous for the defense to have. They'd be there, and they'd cross-examine all the witnesses. But preliminary hearings are very just a synopsis. I think Giroux wanted to test the witnesses and bring them all out and really get – it's almost like a practice trial with no cross-examination.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You write about Judge Boisenecker. How does it get to be that you're assigned this case, and when does this happen?
I believe at the time Judge Boisenecker was the presiding judge of the criminal division of the Napa courts. And so it would go to him to assign usually to someone in the criminal division. In my particular case, I had been in a long assignment in civil. But because I grew up here and the case intrigued me. I actually asked for the assignment if he hadn't already planned on sending it to someone. And the criminal division is very small here in Napa, and they can use the help by assigning it over, and so he did. And that's how I got it.
Let's use the opportunity to stop for a second to hear these commercials. Now, the trial is set. Or at least everyone is getting set for this trial, but there is some there is a phase of the pretrial process where a raft of motions are allowed, and so they have to be examined. In this case, it's particularly interesting when I think the average person might have an idea of, from watching television, watching even documentaries more so, about this previous information that we talked about just briefly, but the previous rapes and assaults and that those criminal convictions, other than the murder of Michelle Wallace, how those are admissible in court, how that some of that, or 4 out of 7 of these incidents were granted as admissible by you. So tell us about these, about this pretrial process and this, these motions and their merit.
Yes, they're called in limine motions, and they had to do, of course, with these past crimes. That was the, I mean, there were in limine motions, or attorneys tend to want to litigate the entire trial, especially in civil law, by
sure.
bringing all these motions, what the judge could let in, what he won't let in, and or she won't let in. And after those rulings, they're hoping that they've gutted the other side's case. In criminal law, it's a lot of things like don't allow a speaking objection, just state your grounds, things like that, just routine things. But the
mm-hmm.
heart of it, the meat of it, was the in limine motions on the prior acts. The defense wanted none of them to come in based on saying
sure.
it's irrelevant. It, just because he may have murdered before doesn't mean he murdered today. And in California law, character evidence is not admissible as a general rule unless the defendant puts his character in evidence. So her argument was it's not relevant. We're not putting his character in issue. The other side, of course, says, well, character evidence is not admissible, but these prior crimes can come in for certain reasons, because there's another code section that allows them, if they're relevant to a laundry list of reasons like motive and intent, common scheme and plan, common design. And so here the district attorney would argue on the rapes where the stocking was off one of the legs but left on the other, and it was the same leg too, and that happened
mm-hmm.
at least twice, that was relevant to show a common scheme and design by the killer. Anyway, it was things like that I was called upon to rule on. I didn't allow some in because they never, on one, they at least one, they never found the body. So there was no conviction, and not even sure it was a murder, and so I didn't let it in. And the other fear that you have to watch as the trial judge is the jury could punish someone if they find out I'm letting something in that never got to trial. They may want to punish them for that prior act. So I always tried to let in things where there was at least a conviction or some procedure where there was cross-examination and evidence.
You allowed the 62 rape of Rhonda T., the 72 rape of Catherine Ortiz, the 74 rape of Sandra Arnold, and, of course, the Michelle Wallace murder.
Right.
You also, what the jury was going to hear, what everyone was going to hear, is the details of the Michelle Wallace murder. I think it was very important. And you talked about a person that was with Melanson that ended up
yes.
hearing about this thing and brief and contacting the police and giving him the details of this. So what were those details, trial, the jurors would listen to, would find out about?
Yes, I think his name was Charles something, but he had passed away by the time of the trial. But he was he met Melanson in a bar, and they were drinking, and Melanson said, I could use some help. I have some horses in the country, and told him to come with him. Charles was Matthews was kind of an old cowboy, but he was a Vietnam veteran, I think decorated even, and suffered from some post-traumatic stress, but a decent person who had served his country, and he went with them. And they went up there and they camped out, and they ended up not chasing down horses like Melanson told them they would. And they spent the night and they just kept drinking. And the next day they were coming back when they saw this woman who ends up being Michelle, who was a young photographer, and she was an independent spirit, and she was up there hiking the hills by herself with her camera. And she, I believe, Dan, I think her car had broke down, and that was perfect for Melanson. That's what he preyed on with people that had a flat tire or broke down car. So she gets in the car, and they're going to go back, I believe, to Gunnison, or maybe they're going to go get some help for her. And Charles is with her, and Roy, and they go back down, I think, into the town, and they let off Charles. So then he leaves them, and they go away, and she's never seen again. One significant thing was Michelle had her dog with her. She had, I think it was a German Shepherd, and Charles loved dogs, and he remembered the dog. He sat in the back seat with the dog when Melanson mm-hmm. and Michelle were in the front seat. So anyway, after it was reported she was missing, it struck him, Charles I'm talking about, and he called the police and said, look, I just was with two other people. One was a young girl with a German Shepherd. So that became, very significant. And then they really zeroed in on Charles, probably as a suspect in a way, but, he phoned it in, and it was clear he had nothing to do with it, but he gave him whatever recollections he had.
The defense was a Miss Walensky.
Yes.
And so when this trial starts, you have Paul Giroux versus Walensky and her team. What are some of the issues that, the evidence that the prosecution has is the bloody towel. Or maybe tell us the evidence that they have, and thanks to DNA, and then how they describe their case and what they will prove. And what Walensky has to say about the case and what it really is all about.
Sure. Giroux has really, when you break it all down, a circumstantial case. He has no direct evidence, where a person sees him murder the other person. It's just circumstantial evidence. And so what he has is DNA evidence from the cigarette butt, which was on the bar. The murder was in the storage room. So he has nothing that puts Melanson in the storage room. There is a towel back in the bar on the other side of the bar where the bartender is underneath the sink, and it's bloody and it's wet, and it does have some DNA of Melanson as well as the victim. So that sort of puts Melanson possibly behind the bar. Now, that's a lot more incriminating. So he's got that, but it's still circumstantial because there's no evidence putting him in the storage room. And then he's got David Luce, who does pick him out of a photo lineup, but he picks him out 37 years later. How reliable is that? I don't know. But there's that. Walensky, on the other hand, attacks it with DNA. She hires an expert who disputes the DNA on the towel, not on the cigarette. She concedes, that's my client's DNA. It does put him in the bar, but nothing puts him in the storage room. And who's to say the time of death is accurate? Who's to say it? Because the medical examiner gave it a range of hours. And so who's to say someone else didn't come in? It's possible. So she argued that she didn't have a lot there, but her expert said the DNA on the towel was very weak, and she explained why. They had to cut out little sections of the towel before they could come up with this, and they did a STRY, which was a male chromosome to exclude all females. And the expert for Walensky said it just wasn't reliable.
Sandra Sue Arnold, now Schiller, was attacked at a gas station or abducted at a gas station February 20th, 1974. And there was no gas at this gas station, and Melanson said he knew where they could get some gas and follow me. And she said, very interesting, she has testified at this trial, so it's very interesting, and she calls him a grandpa. There's some statements she makes that are very indicative of her anger towards this man 37 years later. Tell us about this testimony and if this was effective in this, do you believe?
I believe it was effective. I remember, and Dan, I may not have the exact testimony in front of me here, but I remember her looking at him, just staring at him, and saying something about, yes, I've come, someone asked her, that Giroux or something, that you've come a long way for this, and she said, yes, I have, and I wouldn't miss this, or something like that. I mean, you might say she's biased, but she wanted her day in court. She was still angry. Yeah, he treated her absolutely horribly. And the thing, I don't believe I brought this out, but the attorneys who cross examined her, I think she had reported the rape, and the attorneys who did the cross examination were, you know, in the 70s and from the South, and they would refer to her as little lady. And didn't you willingly go with him into the country? And, you know, and what were you wearing? And you know, she was good in her testimony. She just said, yes, I went to the country because he said he was going to help fix my flat. I didn't consent to go into the swamps. And, you know, and she never objected to little lady. It's just the way the judge didn't either. It's just the way they addressed each other. But it's very condescending.
Yeah. You write that she called him a gross old man and a dirty old cowboy.
That is what she said. That was from the testimony. And, it's what kind of what you just said, Dan. You could tell her animosity towards him. There was no respect, and she was there to do her job.
Now, how does this trial, for the prosecution, what are some of the key people and the key evidence that are successful in prosecuting this case at trial?
I think I have to start with David Luce, who did pick her out of the lineup. He was able to withstand her meaning Walensky's strenuous cross-examination on him, because it was 37 years later that he picks the guy out, or something like that. But he did identify the defendant as being that last person in the bar when he left, so that was significant. Detective Weiniger, was instrumental as he led the prosecution's case. Michelle Terra from the Department of Justice was the criminalist who took the evidence and did the DNA testing and found the match. I talked to her, and she was really devoted to this case. She did, I forget how many tests, and it was over 100, and the average was, you know, homicide was like 3 tests. It was just amazing how thorough she was. And then the old guard police who preserved the evidence, plus that young Berkeley criminalist, Peter Barnett, who did the original crime scene, the analysis and the reconstruction. And one thing, Dan, that I found kind of funny, he was instrumental to the prosecution. He was 27 years old when he was called to Napa on July 11th, 1974, and he was 64 years old when he testified in court in 2011. And so it was you wouldn't think you'd have the same criminalist, but they did. And he was just really good.
It was Muriel's prodding that helped sustain this case and helped the detectives not forget her sister. She didn't make it to this trial, did she? But was she aware was she aware of the progress?
She was.
Before she died?
In 2010, Detective Weiniger went over and told her, "Look, we have a match. We're pretty sure this man did it, and we're going to take him to trial." And one thing I should tell you, she had really faded mentally by then. She was may have been under a conservatorship already or not. I know she was before she died. And what Detective Weiniger said, she said, and this is in no transcript. She never testified or anything, but that she said, I'm glad they caught him, and I want to go see him. And Detective Weiniger said, well, I don't know if we can do that, Muriel. And she's, what do you want? And he says, I want to ask him why. I want to know why he did this. And that's all she said then. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it was very interesting, the Ortiz, Catherine Ortiz, also horrifying testimony as well, what she experienced with the Melanson as well. Tell us about the defense and what they tried to assert happened at this trial and what they tried to assert that the prosecution did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
On Ortiz, that was, and forgive me if I'm mixing it up, but Ortiz was the one where it went to a preliminary examination and not a conviction after trial. I'm just checking with you now. Is that what you, is that the one you're asking me about?
I believe so, yes. But
yeah,
it's okay. The one where, yeah, so we're basically...
She misidentifies?
She basically avoids being killed because her friend, Tiny Richardson, owner of the club, basically was alerted to what the potential danger, and so, murder was certainly averted.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, she again gets conned into going with him, I think, on the flat tire. I think that was a flat tire. And I'll take you, and then he goes the wrong way, and she said, where are we going? And he said, I'm going to rape you, and she said, over my dead body. And she couldn't overcome his strength. He was strong as a bull, she said, and he tied her up with her stockings or something, and he raped her, and he raped her repeatedly, go to different places. And then as she's coming back, he doesn't murder her. This is the one he has great regret, and he starts like sobbing, and she tries to smooth talk him by then. Well, I can see you can be a gentleman after all. And when he was trying to give her some Kleenex or something, and then he does get the tire fixed, and then he asks her to follow him, and she sees her brother's friend, who's a real big guy, coming out of the bar, and I think he owns the bar, and she signals him some way. Melanson can't see it because he's in his own car, having her follow him for her safety, if he wants to get her back to town for her safety. But the big guy sees her signal, so he turns around and he's following. And pretty soon Melanson stops, and she's starting to pull up, and then he sees this other truck or car, I think truck, come up, and he realizes, oh, God, she's got someone, and he just speeds off. And then they go to Miss Ortiz's dad's place, and they call the cops, and that's how they get him.
In this trial, you had the criminal reconstructionist, Peter Barnett's testimony.
Right.
He theorizes, puts things together, makes inferences. What does he say happened that night with Melanson and Anita?
Yeah, he's the one that they brought him down when he was 27, and then he testified later at 64 years old. He theorized that there was after everybody was gone, this discussion that soon turned into a struggle immediately, probably in the bar, and he drags her to the storage room, and he discusses the blood spatter on the different places, and then has the 13 stab wounds that may have been determined by the medical examiner, but he's able to show by the location of the body and the wound in the neck what had happened. Then he found the screwdriver, which was on the sink in the bar, with no prints on it and totally washed off, and in fact a little rusty from being left there to dry, and that's where they found the towel too. So he puts that together and then notices the stocking and believes there was a sexual assault.
You talk about Walensky's closing argument. It basically, you sum it up as some other dude did it defense.
Yes.
And so most expected a speedy conviction in terms of the deliberation from the jury. So it takes a couple days, but the verdict comes back. What is the verdict? What is the sentence?
Yeah, the verdict was guilty to first-degree murder. And I had to sentence him according to the laws of 1974. I couldn't do
right.
it in 2011, and I had to research that, and it was I think it was 25 to life back then, and so I gave him that, and I made it consecutive to the murder for Michelle Wallace. Because
right.
he was going to be up for parole the next year in 2012,
yeah.
and I made it consecutive, wow. and it would ensure, in effect, that he would die in prison, and he has.
Incredible. I want to thank you so much for coming on, Raymond Guadagni, for coming on and talking about the Napa murder of Anita Fajani Andrews, a cold case that caught a serial killer. For those that don't know, this is a History Press book release. Publisher is History Press. But if you have an Amazon page and other books that you have written as well, tell us about this Amazon page and where they can go to take a look at other work.
Sure. I've written two other books, but they weren't true crime. I wrote a memoir of growing up in Napa in the 50s and early 60s and just what life was like then. I really enjoyed that. It was extremely popular in Napa County, and
sure.
and probably pretty well received by anyone of my era, because whether it was Chicago or Napa, kids were still outdoors and playing and golf on their bikes, having fun, building forts and things. And then I wrote one about my dog, Tuna the Wonder Dog. That was a dog I had for 17 and a half years, and you know, he took me through college, law school, my first public defender job, my marriage, and both kids before he passed away.
Wow. Sounds very interesting. I want to thank you so much. The Napa Murder of Anita Fajani Andrews, a cold case that caught a serial killer. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Raymond A. Guadagni. Thank you
Pleasure
so much.
Pleasure for me too, Dan. Thank you very much.
You have a great evening. Good night.
Okay, thank you. You too. Good night.